Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We begin with a robbery that is all the buzz in Chicago. And that robbery took place in broad daylight Saturday afternoon at Gold Coast Exotic Motors. This is Joe Perilla's Rolls-Royce dealership and other exotic cars right there on Rush in the heart of the Gold Coast. And you had two guys who obviously were casing the joint walk in at noon, and one with an air gun and the other with a hammer smashed a bunch of display cases. Didn't go after the cars because there were people doing business there. There were salespeople there. There were customers.
There were families there.
Smashed a bunch of windows and stole between, I've heard varying reports, $1 and $2 million worth of jewelry that's in display cases at his dealership there.
It took 30 seconds, and they stole 7 watches, maybe more. Yeah, worth about more than $1 million.
They knew what they were doing.
Yeah, they knew.
Here's some of what Joe Perilla Sr. had to say. And you know the name Perilla, Perilla BMW. You've seen the family commercials for years. Here's what Sr. had to say.
It's only a fool who keeps doing things the same way and expects different results. If the mayor and Kim Fox don't do anything to get control of this, it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. But right now it's turning into Palookaville.
I appreciate the William Forsythe, Francis McDormand movie reference, yes. Palookaville, very nice. He also, he was upset. He had a lot to say talking about what the city has become versus the city that he knows and loves and has found great success in.
We're here to run a legitimate business, not be a Western shootout. 30 seconds, and they know, the criminals know. If they get arrested, they get let go. So how do you intend to ever solve that problem? And if they don't do anything about this, they're going to lose a lot of businesses. They may lose Macy's, they're losing Neiman Marcus. They may lose this store.
Man, one thing, too, the people who work at Perillo's are armed. A lot of them have a concealed carry. So they went after him, including Joe Abbas.
We ran after them on Chestnut all the way to State Street, and then they split up. And I have a little kids. I didn't want to get shot here.
Because he was thinking the whole time, I've got children, I can't go. I have to come home from work tonight.
Well, this is obviously the fault of Joe Perilla. That's what we understand from Mayor Lightfoot as of last week, amid the string of smash and grab, mob-style looting on Mag Mile in Mag Mile retailers.
Oh, yeah.
The problem is retailers are not doing enough to provide for their own security. Retailers are not taking this seriously, you know, the way that Lightfoot and Fox do. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Joe Perillo's a successful guy. He can afford a bigger security detail, right? He can afford more sophisticated surveillance equipment.
He had sophisticated surveillance. That's why people saw it.
Needs to be more.
Oh,
needs to be more.
Yeah.
He's not doing enough. We know that despite the fact that I think the protocol generally is with crime that you don't blame the victims, you blame the criminals. Not in Chicago. In Chicago, at least as it pertains to retail theft, the victims are responsible in Chicago. That's what we understand the protocol to be. That's right from the mayor's mouth.
I mean, what is he supposed to? And we're going to talk to him at 8:38 this morning. But what is he supposed to do? Have armed guards outside the store looking and checking people before they come into a store? Because that's kind of strange, too.
Makes for a welcoming environment when you're looking to spend $500,000 on a car. Also, I've seen these suggestions online, too, from all of these keyboard cowboys, including in the Chicago press corps, who think they got it all figured out. Joe Perillo, why don't you just have a buzz one person in at a time? Size up people and decide if you want to let them enter your store. That's on you. So if you have some shady-looking characters show up at your front door, don't just allow them to walk in.
Yeah, that's not racist. I mean, come on. Or I heard, too, you know, why are you army? If you're, one of your security guards shoots a suspect, they can go to jail.
Well, that all depends on the context, but obviously these are legitimate concealed carry holders, so you have a right to defend yourself. One guy had a gun. But regardless, all these simple solutions that put the onus on the business owner, and those same people pontificating online pay no mind or make excuses for the political power structure in Chicago. And that's exactly why you have the Chicago you have. The Wall Street Journal editorial board opined over the weekend, the downward spiral of America's second city. No amount of Build Back Better funds will solve the systemic problems. Oh, systemic. Uh-oh. We get to use that word, too. From the excesses of politics to the steady hand of industry, it was always the city that worked. It wasn't. That's one of those urban myths that people outside of Chicago are not paying much attention, don't propagate, but is not actually true. But obviously it wasn't where it is today, where it has become more recognized as the city that works you over.
How soon do we become Detroit or Gary, Indiana? 3 months, 3 years? What do you think? I mean, at this rate, and now I'm learning this morning that Perillo is going to have appointments only for this week. Their dealership, yeah.
Well, that's fine. By the way, that what I was referencing was a letter to the editor from Grady Hauser from South Elgin in the Wall Street Journal. I think I mentioned it as an editorial, but letter to the editor, same thing, just not from the editorial board. But it's not the city that works. It wasn't when it appeared to be working. What you now have is the end of the line, the consequences being visited of all of the decision making and the papering over and, you know, the corruption tax, but it was at a doable level kind of mentality that has built up over generations. Well, now it's time to pay the piper, and everybody is. And so now CTA bus drivers are demanding more protection, and Gold Coast retailers are demanding more protection, and nobody can figure out how we got here. We have been on this journey for a half century. I'm sorry that so many people didn't know where we were going. This is where we're going. So now we're here. I understand. We're here. Now what do you do about it? More of the same? Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. I was at a meeting Friday night in Jefferson Park and Portage Park. In the last like 9 days, we've had one murder, four people shot, all less than a mile from where I live. And this meeting, the superintendent was there, you know, aldermen, you know, detectives, what have you. And, you know, it's more of the same. You know, we're taking more guns off the street and all this other stuff, and people just want to know what the hell is going on and what are you going to do about it. And, you know, and the fact is there ain't much you can do about it, because one of the things that the superintendent said was that, you know, we arrest guys and then they let them out 10 days later or 10 hours later.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it's insane. And, you know, one of the things, with, like, you know, Perillo, you know, she talks about having more security. If Joe Perillo had a guy there with an AR or people armed to the teeth and blew these guys' brains out, it'd be, oh, they're getting their life together and they're not gangbangers and, you know, you guys are white supremacists shooting these poor guys who are just, you know, stealing $1 million worth of watches because they need the cash. It's insane. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call, Greg. And, oh, by the way, as you were sort of alluding to, Amy, you do this, so we're going to size people up and buzz them in.
Yeah, right.
How quickly is he going to face not only discrimination lawsuits, then he's going to face all the race hustlers protesting and calling for boycotts outside his front door. That'll happen like that. The first time some, you know, some guy from the Bears or the Bulls who they don't recognize,
or has a hoodie on or something,
or the Chicago Fire, you know, somebody who's not a white person, who's a young person, but has a lot of money and could afford it and so on and so forth. But he's, you know, not dressed in uniform, or he's a tech entrepreneur that nobody knows. And they come and they're denied because they're dressed like, you know, a rap star. And then it's, you know, the city's up for grabs, systemic racism, blah, 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 bull jive. So you can't win in this scenario if you're Joe Perillo. The only thing you can do is sort of what Greg from Jefferson Park said, and actually what Joe Perillo said, which is, you know, they lost Macy's and they may lose us too. That's what you can do. You can either, you know, make it a bunker or you can leave. Those are your choices. Joe in Hoffman Estates.
Hey, good morning. I think all these smash and grab places, well, like places downtown, I should say, in all these cities are going to end up having to leave once the insurance companies do the cost analysis, just like in Florida, how they don't insure a lot of houses. And they tell them, you know, we just can't keep eating $1 million here, $1 million there in rebuilding.
That is an issue, and we'll talk to him about that.
Thanks for the
Joe
call.
Perillo, Sr.
Joe.
At 8:38, because that is a problem with insurance.
Oh, Randy definitely. On the highway.
Hey, how's it going? Love your show.
Thanks.
I just, by extension, all the stores there in the city are going through this. We have to arm ourselves. We have to defend ourselves. But they're getting blamed for it. When there's nothing left in the city, all these people are going to come out here to the suburbs and start coming to our houses. And by extension, we're going to have to defend ourselves. So it's like, this is exactly why they need to clamp down on criminals. It's wrong.
Thanks for the call. They're already there. I mean, there's already a spike in criminal activity. There was a carjacking at that Burr Ridge Village Center Mall.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
In the middle of the day. I mean, we talked a year ago, maybe longer, about where you are close to train stations out in the burbs, Metra or L. You have people jumping off and taking cars right out of people's driveways, oftentimes because in the suburbs they think they're safe and they were leaving them unlocked. But regardless, so that's been happening at an increased pace for a while as well. Matt, Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy.
Morning.
I just want to say they can have all the security they want, but if they lose their clientele and the customers, they won't need that security because, like Mr. Perillo, they're going to be leaving. You know, like Citadel, they'll be pulling out of this city. It will be a wasteland. And Amy, I know you're in Detroit last weekend or whatever it was, but we're going to be Detroit very, very quickly here. So have a good day, folks.
Thanks for the call, Matt. And it's hard to say, but all I will say is, to quote the great financier Ted Forstman, people underestimate how good things can get, but they also underestimate how bad things can get.
Bingo.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest guests and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And this is why it's so difficult to change the mindset. You know, to borrow from Ludwig von Mises, he who wants to improve conditions must propagate a new mentality, not merely a new institution. In Chicago, we're all about institutions and personnel within those institutions. We just need somebody new on the fifth floor. We just need this new alderman. We just need this new Cook County state's attorney mentality. So I noted Greg Hines, who's, you know, part of the Chicago Democrat Socialist Comm Shop that masquerades as a press corps. He writes this piece for the Anti-Business Business Magazine in Chicago, which again speaks to mentality. End of last week, this is the job you ran for, Mayor Lightfoot, attempting to chastise her because of how the city is beset by crime, how the city's unraveling. And he referred to a gathering of young people that turned violent, literally the phrase he used in describing one of these orchestrated mob looting forays.
Undocumented shopping? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's what he—oh, all right.
A gathering of young people turned violent.
See, the problem with reporters like him and others, they don't ever go out and are there. They report from the safety of their homes and through social media, and they never go down and actually see it and feel the fear. But go on.
It wouldn't matter because they're not there to recount what happened or to comment fairly on what occurred in the case of Hines, who's a more of a commentator than he is a reporter. They're there to push an agenda. And the agenda is, well, it played out in my comment on his post and his response. I tweeted out, a gathering of young people turned violent. Harsh. Next time, go with honor students, Greg. And I went on to say the Dem Socialist Comm Shop, a.k.a. the Chicago Political Press Corps, rivals the Babylon Bee when they stage pillow fights with their identitarian peeps, which is what that is. Greg Hines criticizing Lori Lightfoot, that is a staged pillow fight to pretend like you have a political press corps in Chicago. You don't.
That's great.
So his response was to accuse me of being a racist.
Oh, of course. Low-hanging fruit. Now, how did he term it?
Young people do have a right to gather, Dan, whether you like their skin color or not. They don't have a right to break the laws.
Oh. See, that's unfair. That's unjust. And please tell me how you responded.
Well, you can go on my Twitter and see the whole back and forth. But I just said, let you embarrass yourself by offering your tired race baiting. You only live down to my characterization of you and your servile brethren. You and your leftist goons are the great protectors of Chicago's youth. You've done a wonderful job. It's going very well. And the point here is to say that this is the same tack that Mayor Lightfoot took. First, let's establish for people, young people have a right to gather and enjoy the city. Is anybody saying they don't? It's a straw man. It's a straw man, and dare I take a page out of their book, it's a dog whistle. Pay attention to that. Don't pay attention to what's actually happening. It's not a gathering of young people that turns violent. It's a gathering of young people, including a group of young people who had violence on their mind. It was premeditated, and they executed what they came to do, which is do a smash and grab robbery.
Yeah, at three different stores, and then proceeded. You know, then things got ugly, and then for blanks and giggles, they just say, "Hey, let's just beat up a bus driver. Why not?"
Well, right. So the whole idea, like they were,
there for peaceful purposes, kids have a right to go downtown, but they don't have a right to do that. And this was premeditated. It was planned on social media. They wanted to do it again this weekend, but they couldn't because they knew there was beefed
up security. Of course,
this is
so obvious.
Right.
It's obvious to everybody. Oh yeah, they were doing a poetry recital in Millennium Park, and then they decided, you know what, it would be more fun to smash up some stores and steal as much as we can. No, of course not. But young people have a right to gather, even if you don't like their skin color. And then he continues to press that issue. You know, just say you don't want black teenagers to gather, or you don't like black teenagers, and so on and so forth. Nothing to do with that. Of course, it has to do with people's behavior. I don't care what their skin color is, and he shouldn't either if he's for the rule of law, but he's not. He's for saying that if law and order is a dog whistle to them to say, go after black kids or go after black families or go after minorities, that's what this is really about, or tell minority families you can't come to the city. That is all absolute silliness. Silliness. It is cheap racial demagoguery from your political press corps in Chicago. And so as long as the Greg Hineses and the rest, basically 99% of the rest of the press corps are out there, and you have, basically a leftist adult population in Chicago, how does anything change? You think because you put more cops on the street that will change something? It's Band-Aid. It will stop the violence in the short term, and that's what we have a moral imperative to do. We have a moral imperative to provide for the security of people as best we can in the immediacy while we talk about these sort of medium and long-term cultural and socioeconomic problems. So this is not to dismiss that, but it's to say that doesn't return Chicago to some stylized notion of what you think Chicago was 30 years ago. Replacing Lightfoot doesn't do it. Replacing Fox doesn't do it. Putting another 1,000 cops on the street doesn't do it. Does it incrementally improve the situation temporarily? Okay. does it change the calculus of the business owner, the retailer on the Mag Mile, or the bank or the hedge fund? Probably not. They tend to be more medium to long-term thinkers. So it seems to me you have to piece this out a little bit. There's the, you know, emergency of the moment that has to be addressed, and that's just the general lawlessness. But then we're sort of papering over these medium and long-term problems that have been building for generations, as I said before the break. We've been on this road for a long time, and the farther you go down this road away from civilization, the more treacherous the road gets. And I don't think people have an appreciation for that. A lot of people don't. If we just replace these people, if we just do this with police, if we just do this, it's going to be all better. It's not going to be all better. It's not. This took us a long time to get here. And you think that it's one thing or two things, a personnel change or a slight dial turn on an institution, that's going to make this place something other than what it is at present? No. I hate to break it to you. I hate to be the wet blanket here, because I know it's just easier to believe one person, that mayor, that police chief, that Cook County prosecutor, and then it all turns around. That's not how it's going to go. It's not. You got a political culture problem in Chicago that spread like a virus to most of the rest of the state. It's a failed city and a failed state. And you don't turn that around overnight. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy, and thanks for taking a call. Listen, the problem is, and the answer to Amy's question before about what to do, well, Joe Pereira should just turn over all his goods and wealth and everything to the thugs and everything, because this leftist people in charge in government, I mean, this is exactly what they want. They don't want anyone to be able to have small business and be able to be independent of the government. They want everyone to be dependent on the government. That's why they keep taking, destroying all the businesses and paying out all this, giving all this money, free money away in America. This is what they want. They don't want any answers to take and collect anything, because it's going just as they have got it planned.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Laura Washington, writing in the Sun-Times, the AFL-CIO Times, talking about that 71-year-old man who was gunned down in Chinatown.
For no reason, just going to get a newspaper. Father, grandfather, great community leader. People loved him.
She writes, within an hour of the shooting, Chicago police arrested this 23-year-old of Morgan Park. By a few days later, he had been charged with first-degree murder. She writes, this is a model to champion.
What?
Because the Chinatown gentleman's neighbors leapt into action. A community watch group called the police district commander within minutes. Police Superintendent Brown told the media, Chinatown Chamber of Commerce, you turned over critical surveillance video to help detectives get the license plate for the car. Officers tracked the car to the Kennedy, arrested the guy, found a gun equipped with an extended magazine in his car. And as Brown said, the people of Chinatown helped us bring this offender to justice. That's a model to live by. And she then goes on to provide one of the pro forma laments. That's what needs to happen in the black community. She writes, Laura Washington, I want to hear those shout outs in Chicago's most crime infested neighborhoods, from Inglewood to Roseland to Austin. The police can't do it alone. We can't wait for them. When violent brutality invades our communities, the police can't always be there. Right. No kidding. Police department, 25% arrest rate for 730 homicides over the last year. For 3,500 plus shootings, the arrest rate was 10%. She writes, the anti-snitching philosophy that prevails in too many communities on the South and West Side cannot stand. It is rooted in fear of retaliation and distrust of the police. Mm-hmm. And, Laura, you and your colleagues in the Democrat Socialist Party's press corps, comm shop, what are your contributions? Where did the fear of retaliation and distrust, the distrust of police and that distrust that engenders more fear of retaliation because the belief that the police won't protect me. Right. Where did that come from? Did it come from police abuse from a bygone era? Yes, in part. What about the last 30 years? What about the last 20? What about the last 5? Where did it come from? How does this myth of police as predator looking for black men and women to roust, harass, or worse, where does that come from? It comes from police?
Comes from their paper.
It comes from the AFL-CIO Times. Mm-hmm. It comes from Laura Washington. It comes from the entire defund and decarcerate Democrat Socialist Party to which they are all affiliated. And so they bought our propaganda, right, is what Laura Washington's really saying, and it turns out it's killing them, and they need to stop. Well, we're going to continue propagandizing, and then I'm going to write an op-ed to say, hey, you know, you got to step up like the families in Chinatown did when something terrible happens so that people are brought to justice because the police can't do it alone. The police you want to defund? I thought you didn't want the police to do anything at all. This is the hopelessly conflicted sentimental barbarism of Chicago. It's a mentality. People will read Laura Washington's column and like, oh, yeah, mm-hmm, as this is some novel notion. And they'll completely miss the paradoxical nature of it. They'll completely miss their own paradoxical nature as they nod along to Laura Washington. Mentality, mentality, mentality. Tom, Northwest Side.
Morning, guys. Enjoy the show. I like the pillow fight reference. That was
good.
Humorous.
Thank you.
My finest work.
Thank you very much. I should have said my pillow.
The group, the Who, about 40 years ago, had a line in their song, Meet the New Boss, Same as the Old Boss.
Oh, yeah.
And that's exactly what it's going to be. If Triple Threat or Jim Soros don't get reelected, there'll be another, figurehead to do their bidding.
Right.
It's, you get what you vote for.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Right. We got, the Great White Hope, the Jerry Cooney of Democrat Socialist Politics, Arne Duncan in the offing. That's going to change something?
Oh, my God.
What a
Steve
joke.
Steve from Blue's Clues.
Even some, like. Here's the other thing that people don't get too. Zaid Jilani had a good piece about this in his Substack. You don't understand those on the center left, those that this is the only choice. You think I'll go with the least worse and at least we'll get this. No, you won't. You don't understand what the left is. You have to sign on to the entire program.
Or else we'll get you.
You don't get to go a la carte when it comes to these new Marxists. You're in for a penny. You're in for a pound. And I don't think a lot of these sort of passively engaged dilettantes meandering about the city hoping not to get shot appreciate that. Oh, I just like her or him for this. That's real nice. Here's what you're actually going to get. You get the full menu, whether you want it or not, and it's rammed down your throat. David McCook.
Hey, good morning, guys. I got to pick on you, Amy, real quick. I love you, kid, but last week I called in and had the suggestion of using a water cannon or a fire hose to stop these mobs.
Right.
The first thing you said was, oh, my God, how would the optics of that look? Which tells me nobody is serious about any of this. We're more worried about optics than stopping some of this crime.
All right, David. Corey Woodlawn.
I do want to say this. We, for years, have allowed these small, minor encroachments, and now this is at the 5-yard line. Mm-hmm. This isn't going to be stopped by one measure here, one measure there. We need a game changer in the city of Chicago. And I did want to say one thing about blacks in the black community, because I've worked with CAPS. I've worked with the District Advisory Council. It is a lot that needs to happen. A lot of residents complain. If you go into those CAPS offices, 2,300 calls a month to the police. But it's 5-6 people sitting in CAPS, and the gangbangers are in there too, seeing who's snitching.
Ooh.
It's a big problem.
Okay. Fair point.
Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Corey. Wow. Appreciate it. Appreciate the perspective. Look, this is not to say any institution is beyond reproach or conversation, including police, and we've never taken that position. John in Portage Park.
Yeah, maybe it's too early to make light of this, but maybe Triple Threat should think about having Kyle Rittenhouse come as security for Mr. Perillo.
Thanks, John. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. One of the godfathers of neoconservatism, along with Irving Kristol, is Norm Podhoretz. And he did the weekend interview with the Wall Street Journal with Barton Swaim. It's really good. He's really interesting. His son, like Bill is to Irving, is sort of a shadow of the intellect that their respective fathers are, Norm Podhoretz, Irving Kristol, Bill Kristol, John Podhoretz. Norm Podhoretz was the editor of Commentary Magazine for more than three decades. And you know, neoconservatism was this idea that America should assert its power to advance freedom and democracy the world over. And, of course, that in practice turned into some incursions and nation-building gambits that we would later come to regret, I would say. Nonetheless, it's a really interesting interview because of Podhoretz's observations about the culture war, for lack of a better phrase, that's going on. He talks about the Youngkin win in Virginia and the Almost win in New Jersey. He says, I wasn't sure they were still out there, the deplorables. I really didn't know. If the results had gone the other way, I wouldn't have been that surprised. Our troops were not as visible, at least to me, because the media and the culture are all on the other side. The other side has won the culture. That's one battlefield. But they haven't yet won the polity. That's very encouraging. They've won the institutions, but they haven't won the people, is what Podhoretz is saying. And Podhoretz goes on to talk a little bit about his life from military service to public intellectual. But and it's interesting. He talks about serving in the Army with a lot of Southern boys, real rednecks, as he called them. But he compares them to the sort of deplorables of the day. He says they're sane. They know there's something wrong. Let's say when a guy says he's a girl, they look at that and say, what, are you effing crazy? All that stuff. He contrasts these deplorables with something like what the Russians call the intelligentsia. He writes, or Podhoretz says in this interview, the intelligentsia thought it was wrong that people who've made a lot of money in business should be our leaders. They resented it. They were not being accorded the power they thought they deserved. But as time went on, they were accorded more and more power, and they stayed resentful. The intelligentsia in America is still resentful, despite the power. They don't like America. And this is central to Podhoretz's writing, more so than disagreements and his thinking, more so than disagreements about the Iraq War. As Swaim properly observes, Podhoretz's journalism always rooted in gratitude to the United States and skepticism of credentialed experts. And so this is the perfect foray to Trump. And Podhoretz says, I was, to begin with, anti-Trump. I was not crazy about the guy. Never met him. I've still never met him. But I thought the animosity against him was way out of proportion and on the right, a big mistake. I went from anti-Trump to pro-Trump. I still think, and it's been the same fight going on in my lifetime since I would say 1965, I still think there's only one question. Is America good or bad? A force for good in the world or not? That's the fundamental question to Podhoretz. And I like that framing, even if you don't think that's the fundamental question, because it does present a real divide between the sane, as Podhoretz described, and the deplorables and the Democrat socialists the leftist intelligentsia. The answers are completely opposed. They do not believe America is good or a force for good, and the deplorables do. And that's not to say flawless, it's to say good, a force for good, warts and all. They believe America should be remade in their image because it's bad. To its DNA, that's the 1619 Project. That's critical race theory in the schools. That's the entire drumbeat of the left that underlies every single position they take on every single issue. And everything is, of course, apocalyptic. It's apocalyptic because we need radical transformation of all aspects of a free society to make it less free, if free at all, because it's bad. Good, bad. Doesn't get more binary than that. And he writes about his, or he says in this interview, I keep saying writes, he says in this interview with Swaim, Swaim writes it, he said that the left understands the fight, and he writes, I'm not sure anymore what our side wants. The right, as I used to understand it, no longer exists. So you've got one very clear side and one very muddled side. And he says Trump was the only guy who understood the situation in the terms in which we find ourselves. Swaim asks him, a sizable contingent of the right still believes that solid reporting through scholarship and careful argumentation will win the respect of their ideological adversaries on the basis of fairness and merit. Is that way of thinking a failure to understand the nature of the conflict? And Podhort says, I do. It is a failure. I think so. Trump was the guy who understood that approach was a failure to understand the nature of the conflict. And Podhort puts it in no uncertain terms, saying, look, this woke business, critical race theory, Black Lives Matter, all of it is just pure anti-American hatred, which is why I keep saying it's a war. If you don't understand that, then you don't know what the hell's going on. Norm Podhort.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. We also have our text message line fired up, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And that interview is so perfectly timed because it provides essentially a response to the piece in The Atlantic that had the D.C. press corps all aflutter this weekend, last week into this weekend, from Bart Gellum talking about Trump's next coup has already begun. January 6th was practice. Donald Trump's GOP is much better positioned to subvert the next election. Trump and the right are in the business of subverting elections. He writes, the next attempt to overthrow a national election may not qualify as a coup. It will rely on subversion more than violence, although each will have its place. If the plot succeeds, the ballots cast by American voters will not decide the presidency in 2024. Thousands of votes will be thrown away, or millions, to produce the required effect. The winner will be declared the loser. The loser will be certified president-elect. And he talks about the prospect of Democratic, small d, collapse being very real and something the capital D Democrat socialists aren't taking seriously enough. He was on over the weekend with one of the on one of the fungible show. Oh, he was on PBS with Judy Woodruff. That's right. And Bart Gellum, the author of that, the Trump's next coup is already afoot, had this to say.
You spent a lot of time trying to understand who the people are who believe that former President Trump won re-election, who don't believe that Joe Biden was lawfully elected. And you point out that these are not lone wolves, that these are people who are part of ordinary communities around the country.
That's right. There was a typical profile for politically violent people in the past has been young and male and unemployed and low education, among other things. Look at what happened on the January 6th insurgency. Look at the defendants in those cases. There are lots of women. The mean age is 42 years old. So these are middle-aged people, well-off, white-collar jobs, own their own businesses. They are not small cells of violent predators, or they're not lone wolves. What they are is part of a mass movement that believes that Trump was robbed of victory, and believe that violence is justified to restore him to power.
And how many people do you believe fit into that category?
Well, the best research on this I know of is done out of the University of Chicago, and they have found that there are about 21 million Americans who agree with two propositions. One is that Biden is an illegitimate president, and the other is that violence is justified to put Trump back in power. That's 21 million adult Americans, and that is a very sad number for our political enterprise.
Right. So remember when we told you that what happened on 1-6, the real play was to characterize every Trump voter, all 73 million plus, as somebody who vandalized the Capitol on that day? Whether you could have, even if you didn't attend the rally.
Right. Remember all the text messages? You're responsible for this. You did this.
Every
single
person.
You let this happen. Yep.
And so now what we are is we're either one of the 21 million. I'd like to see the methodology on that.
Yeah, I'm not buying that.
Assessment. But we're one of the 21 million who thinks that violence to install somebody is the way that we should do our elections in this country, or the way that we should elevate the leader of this country, or we're accomplices to those 21 million. We said that that's what the left would do, attempt to characterize everybody as such, to marginalize everybody for those purposes, to try and intimidate some to not participate. You really want to go with those barbarians? You really want to go with those Philistines who believe in violence? Come over here where we have mostly peaceful riots. And so this is the line of attack coming from the left. It has from the beginning, just kind of sort of radiating out from 1-6 as they demonize more and more groups of people, as they go after people, as we talked about a bit on Friday. Molly Hemingway talked about it, too. We'll get to her in a second. Infringe upon people's constitutional rights because anything's fair game. So they say there is this violent threat. Trump and his 21 million American mercenary force that's going to overthrow the government. Essentially what he's saying. And so anything is justified to stop them. So who's really making the power play here? And something else. Why might some otherwise successful, independent, right-thinking Americans lose faith in their institutions? Why do you think that is? Why might they not believe the party line coming from Bart Gellman and all his friends at the Atlantic and in the D.C. press corps? Christopher Wray, in March, under questioning from Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley about Brian Sicknick's death.
There's been conflicting reports about his cause of death. What? Have you determined the exact cause of death? And is there a homicide investigation?
So I'll take the last part of your question first. There is an ongoing investigation into his death. I have to be careful at this age, because it's ongoing, not to get out in front of it. But I certainly understand and respect and appreciate the keen interest in what happened to him. After all, he was here protecting all of you. And as soon as there are information that we can appropriately share, we want to be able to do that. But at the moment, the investigation is still ongoing.
So does that mean, since the investigation is going on, you have not determined the exact cause of the death?
That means we can't yet disclose a cause of death at this stage.
But you have determined the cause of death.
I didn't say that. We're not at a point where we can disclose or confirm a cause of death. Oh,
so that was March 2nd. So that's 2 months after January 6th. And then it was a month later when it was finally disclosed he died of natural causes. 2 months.
He had a stroke.
2 months of the D.C. press corps. Brian Sicknick was murdered. The deaths that day, Brian Sicknick, Brian Sicknick. This is at the hands of the Trump mob. And then Christopher Wray let it go on for another month, even though 2 months in, the FBI knew or should have known, but he wouldn't disclose it. He gave those middling answers you've come to expect from these imperious government appointees before Congress.
Brian Sicknick's family knew he didn't die from a hit on the head from a fire extinguisher. And they're trying to tell the media that no one would listen.
So why do people lose faith in the rule of law? That the rule of law is something in this country, that there is equal justice before the law, that those charged with enforcing the law are leveling with them. Gosh, why would they lose faith in that? Thomas Massie, Republican congressman of Kentucky, just a couple of weeks ago when Merrick Garland was before the House Oversight Committee asking him about January 6th and the suggestions that have been made, the assertions that have been made, that there were undercover FBI present and maybe instigating. These are assertions that have been made. It's an opportunity for Merrick Garland to say yes or no.
Right.
This is a few weeks ago. This is 11 months, 10 months after 1/6.
All right, you have those images there, and they're captioned. They were from January 5th and January 6th. As far as we can determine, the individual who was saying he'll probably go to jail, he'll probably be arrested, but they need to go into the Capitol the next day, is then the next day directing people to the Capitol. And as far as we can find, this individual has not been charged with anything. You said this is one of the most sweeping investigations in the history. Have you seen that video or those frames from that video?
So as I said at the outset, one of the norms of the Justice Department is to not comment on impending investigations, and particularly not to comment about particular scenes or particular individuals.
I was hoping today to give you an opportunity to put to rest the concerns that people have that there were federal agents or assets of the federal government present on January 5th and January 6th. Can you tell us, without talking about particular incidents or particular videos, how many agents or assets of the federal government were present on January 6th, whether they agitated to go into the Capitol, and if any of them did?
So I'm not going to violate this norm of the rule of law. I'm not going to comment on an investigation that's ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not the rule of law. That's not the rule of law. And you can in perpetuity not comment because there's a pending investigation, an investigation that, is a ship that may never find a port as far as the Department of Justice is concerned, it would seem. As politically sensitive as it is, this, coup attempt that is afoot, this insurrection that, as they term it, that occurred, and 11, 10 and a half months later, you can't say whether or not the federal government had law enforcement personnel or assets present on 1/6. The FBI has come out and said they have no evidence that there was any central organization for it. So, which goes to Molly Hemingway's point about this pending investigation and these prosecutions that are ongoing regarding 1/6. No central planning. That's what the FBI said. It was something they were able to comment on, even though it's a pending investigation and there are pending prosecutions, A.G. Garland, and yet.
But they're going after hundreds of people for the crime of First Amendment protected activities. They are asking for a ton of records for people who did nothing wrong and are not accused of doing anything wrong, who merely applied for permits to have peaceful protests right on January 6th. They're going back to April 2020, and the media are not concerned in any way, even though this is a horrific precedent, if you care about the First Amendment.
So if it wasn't orchestrated, why are you going back to April 2020, 1/6 Commission? If the play here isn't to do exactly what I said and what we predicted, like on January 7th, take the 500 people arrested and make them representative of 73 million Trump voters. You're either in the 21 million person bucket of violent overthrowers that are out there or your accomplices to them. Tina Joliet, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, guys. Hey, I just wanted to touch on something you said earlier, that the Trump voter is quiet, but we're still here. So I was running errands yesterday doing some Christmas shopping. I ran into a store proudly wearing my Trump winter hat, and I had, an older gentleman was there shopping with another man, and sheepishly walked up to me and kind of whispered, "I like your hat." And I said, "Oh, thank you. You should get one too. You should be wearing it." And that started a conversation in which another woman overheard us. She piped in, joined us, stood there, and another woman walked over and joined us. And we're all talking about the state of the country, what's going on, and that we still can't believe what we're witnessing and what's happening here. And we all talked about having to get out of Illinois because we just don't see hope. And that, we talked about Adam Kinzinger. We talked about everything. So we are still here. We're still fighting. I encourage every last one of them. What's sad to me is that they told me how brave I was to wear my hat in public. It's mm-hmm. a winter hat with right. the president's name on it. And that's not an act of bravery. It's crazy to me that people are so afraid of repercussions based on who they support politically. We're in a very, very sad, sad time in this country. And I pray to God we see some changes in the midterm. But thanks. That was the overall sentiment. And they were so happy to see somebody who thought and said the same things that they said.
Thanks for the call, Tina. Appreciate it. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Good morning. In your earlier discussion, it's interesting that what Mr. Potteritz is talking about, it's interesting or ironic that it was Wilson, President Wilson, who was the first president who really pushed us out to be a force for good in the world, the whole make the world safe for democracy. And now they're totally against that. It's America's horrible. America's an evil place. And to answer Mr. Potteritz on what your earlier caller was talking about, too, Americans want to be focused on. They want their needs to be focused on. We need a middle-class warrior president and or several senators to look out for us. Every time that the government focuses on other things and has these foreign adventures, whether it's to do good or not, you get blowback. Look at Korea with Truman. Look at the Vietnam War with Johnson. Look at the Iraq War with Bush. So that's what we really want. We really want guys like Senator Justin Morrill to push the Morrill Act, which created the land-grant colleges and the Transcontinental Railroad and the internal improvements there and the Homestead Act. That's the type of thing today that we need and that a lot of Americans in the middle class want.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Appreciate it.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
I want Christmas. Just give me plain baby Jesus lying in a manger. Christmas.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Oh, boy.
Oh, boy, what?
The League of United Latin American Citizens is going to be in trouble. Domingo Garcia, the president of LULAC, League of United Latin American Citizens, the nation's oldest Latino civil rights organization, sent a memo out instructing staff and board members to drop the word Latinx from the group's official communications.
Thank God. I refuse to use that term.
By the way, LULAC.
So my kids, it's ridiculous.
And LULAC is a left-wing organization. I mean, it certainly leans left.
Okay.
Let's stop using Latinx in all official communications. He added that it's very unliked by almost all Latinos. The email he sent out included a link to a Miami Herald editorial with the headline, "The Latinx community doesn't want to be called Latinx, just drop it, progressives." Well, that's easy to say, but I assume that LULAC is going to be hearing from a lot of shrill, angry white
people,
white suburban leftist harridans with pea hats on, driving their Mercedeses about this because they call the shots. And again, the Latino people,
yes,
are to follow their lead. They know what's in the best interests, including nomenclature for Latino families, don't they?
No, that's the thing. I mean, I'll know because my kids are Latinos. I call them Latinos. And they're like, Mom, what's this Latinx thing? Does that mean I'm gay? What does that mean?
You're always the last to know, son.
I know. I was like, you know, you're like, shouldn't we have a say in this? Because we're Latino. I'm like, no, white people decide what you should be called, how you should be called, and you're supposed to just sit back and take it. So it's a good learning moment, I thought.
Domingo Garcia telling NBC News, the reality is there's very little to no support for its use, and it's sort of seen as something used inside the Beltway in Ivy League tower settings, while LULAC always reps Jose and Maria on Main Street in the barrio, and we need to make sure we talk to them the way they talk to each other. I don't know of any abuelita that calls her granddaughter, hey, you Latinx.
Abuelita, yeah.
Yeah.
They don't.
I assume.
Come here, my little Latinxes.
But it's nice to see the It's nice to see that sort of pushback. Also, a good piece from our friend Glenn Lowry, who's an econ professor at Brown University, in First Things, The Case for Black Patriotism. And there's, you know, references, speaking of the ivory tower, and some good advice, not imposition, that's the difference, conservatives versus the leftists, good advice from Glenn Lowry. I also think this has something to do with our conversation about crime in Chicago and in big cities around the country. The people who have been brainwashed into thinking America is bad, and so I get to be bad because America is bad.
Oh.
He writes, says Glenn Lowry, I'm a black American intellectual in an age of persistent racial inequality. I'm an Ivy League college professor and a descendant of slaves. I came up in the 50s and the 60s on Chicago's South Side. I'm a beneficiary of the Civil Rights Revolution, which made possible for me a life that my forebears only dreamed of. I'm an economist who believes in the virtue of markets, property, entrepreneurship, sound money, and free enterprise. I'm a patriot who loves his country. I'm a patriot who loves his country. I'm a man of the West, and he, as he said before, what's this? Tolstoy is mine. Dickens is mine. Newton and Maxwell and Einstein are mine. Exactly. This effort to eliminate and rewrite, eliminate people from history who have contributed so much because of their intersectionality score, or suggest that those are just old dead white guys like our founders, or like these great intellectuals and great artists, that they don't belong to black people because they're white any more than a great black businessman, artist, athlete, whatever, who's an American, belongs to all of us, you know, as part of America, which belongs to all of us. And that's what Glenn Lowry's saying, and he's good to say it. I wish to make the case for unabashed black patriotism, for the forthright embrace of American nationalism by black people. The currently fashionable standoffishness, characteristics of much elite thinking concerning blacks' relationship to the American project, serves the interests of neither the country nor of black Americans. The America ain't so great and never was posture, popular on campuses and in liberal newsrooms, is a sophomoric indulgence for blacks in the 21st century. Our birthright citizenship in this great republic is an inherent immense value. Our Americanness is much more important than our blackness. Wow. I mean, I'm not surprised because we know Glenn, but
and
one of the reasons he's so important is not just because he's a great intellect, but he's a great writer and a communicator, great intellect economically in terms of economics, the discipline, but he's also a great communicator, writer, and he's just the clarity of his thinking is something that's just really enjoyable. And he makes a point that you have to address. You can't ignore it. So is LULAC right? Latinx, which is just a silly manifestation of this identitarianism of the left.
Well, I remember you told me what it was on the show years ago.
Is Glenn Lowry right? For black people, it's a sophomoric indulgence, America Ain't So Great Never Was silliness that you hear from the great assemblage of the left. This flies right off of our conversation. Norm Podhoretz, Wall Street Journal Weekend Interview, we're talking about before the break. Fundamental question, America force for good or force for bad? Our birthright citizenship is in this great republic is an inheritance of immense value. Our Americanness is much more important than our blackness. That's a statement that is reviled within all of these institutions that purport to be run by our betters. Reviled. And the great thing about Lowry and black intellectuals like him is I got all the chops you got. You hoity-toity academic types. I got all the chops. I got all the credentials. It's like when we talk to, and we'll talk to later in the show, Dr. Roger Klein, formerly of the Cleveland Clinic. I got all the chops you got, Fauci. All the credentials. Dr. J. Bhattacharya from Stanford. Dr. Kaldor from Harvard. Got all the chops. So now you got to deal with me as a quote-unquote expert. But I don't come at it from that pompous position of the those who think they are your betters, the Faucis, the full assemblage of the left that's going to tell you what to call yourself, Latinx. Really interesting. Teresa Northside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. And encouraging.
Good morning, Amy and Dan. I know, what is it with this going up and down the alphabet? For God's sakes, I'm sick of it. But anyway, anyone who thinks America is not a force for good, we are the first country to provide aid to our country and to other countries. I mean, food for the poor is a great example of that. We go to other countries to offer assistance, medical help, education, and the list goes on and on and on. So if you don't like America, if you hate America, then get out. It's just that simple.
Well, thanks for the call, Teresa. Or get, you know, wake up. Or confront Glenn Lowry's argument. Confront what LULAC is saying and who they represent. And by the way, you know, all of those, as he said, Jose and Maria's on Main Street that they represent. Something else that's happening, too, which is another encouraging note. I want to provide some encouraging notes here. Is surveys research recently that suggests that the distribution of R versus D among the Latino population in this country, about 50-50 now.
Really? That's good. That's
so
encouraging.
That is, and you can bet that was that factored into the decision that LULAC, an organization that leans left, made about this progressive terminology that's rejected by the people they seek to represent and speak on behalf of, at least to some extent.
And they did it, yeah. But they did it all because LGBTQ wanted this inclusion term, because you might not be, if you're a Latina or a Latino, and they're like, no, it's got to be Latinx because maybe she is really a he.
Right.
It's all this, you know, progressive gobbledygook.
But I wonder if those are canaries in the coal mine in terms of a reshaping of the political landscape in this country. And as I said before, all of those disgusting white leftist suburban women, if we can get to a day where Republicans don't spend a single moment thinking about them, much less trying to attract their vote, and can just focus on continuing to grow this mission field of Latinos that are moving away from the left, of young black Americans that are moving away from the left, of those who are reading Glenn Lowry and shaking their head up and down, yes, that would be a happy day. I'd love to see that as the governing party here. You want a multiracial, multi-ethnic party? Do so on the bases that Glenn Lowry in particular offers in his op-ed, making the case for black nationalism. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Representative Mike McCall, who's the ranking Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, was on with Mike Emanuel on Fox over the weekend to offer his informed assessment of the state of play with respect to a possible Russian invasion of Ukraine.
And, you know, Putin has taken a look at this, along with President Xi in China. He's always wanted Ukraine. It's a breadbasket of Russia. And his calculation is that this is a weak president, and now is the time. And I would also say, Mike, that his waiver of congressional sanctions on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which will allow Putin to complete his pipeline into Europe, was a major foreign policy blunder that just emboldened and empowered Putin, which now gives him leverage over Europe and NATO right now.
And McCall sort of said, almost in passing, but it's more important than a passing comment, that likely, Putin will take the port of Odessa. And then the question is, then does he go to Poland? Does he go to the Baltics?
Where we were going to send LNG, clean energy, and now he's probably going to maybe take that over. I think there's going to be more and more aggression to restore the old glory of the Soviet empire. That is his ultimate goal here.
For more on this and other geopolitical topics, please be joined for our weekly confab with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP at the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of the book Brutal War, Jungle Fighting, Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, best Merry Christmas to you guys.
First thing,
oh, thank you very much. Keep an eye on McCall. He is a really interesting guy, congressman from Texas. Developing some very serious foreign policy chops. Definitely, I think, a conservative leader to keep an eye on in the future. Putin is the only guy that really knows what Putin is going to do. He has all the options on the table. And so anybody who says this is what Putin is going to do misses the big thing, which is actually Putin will decide what's best for him. And I can actually argue both sides of this. You know, on the one hand, you would be fighting 44 million people who are going to fight back in Ukraine and fight back very, very hard. If you conquered the country, you'd have to pay to maintain it. They pay $20 billion just to keep little tiny Transnistria in Moldova. So it would be an enormous burden on the administration. Of course, they would be a global pariah. So there's a downside to that. But I'm not saying Putin is not going to do that. I had a delegation from a country that's very close to Russia, probably the people that follow the Russians more closely than anybody and who really understand them extremely well. And their assessment is Putin must at some point reconquer the Ukraine. He might well think that today is the day to roll the dice and take all the marbles. So you have both sides of it there.
Well, if Putin does invade Ukraine, what is the USA's role and our allies' role going to be in it?
Well, I think we will be supporting. I think support the Ukrainians. And like I said, there's 44 million Ukrainians. They've got a million people under arms. They're going to fight really, really hard. And when the pictures show up of the bombing and the dead bodies and everything else, the world is going to get really, really upset with Putin. This might not be the easiest invasion ever. It is the middle of winter. As it gets colder, it actually gets better for military operations because the ground is more solid. On the other hand, and you can't dig foxholes and stuff like that. On the other hand, Ukrainians know they're coming. They can dig their foxholes now. The Russian army is very powerful, except they really don't have very good logistical systems. So sustaining a military in a prolonged campaign over time would be a real challenge for them, particularly in winter. So it's not a free lunch for them.
Holman Jenkins writes in the Wall Street Journal that the threats of sanctions, lethal aid to the Ukrainians, weapons to the Ukrainians. He writes that the U.S. has actually been, I'm quoting him, the U.S. has actually been quite shy of actions that might destabilize Mr. Putin's regime. And he goes through a litany of things that, if publicly disclosed, particularly on intel matters, would make it very difficult for Western leaders to continue to countenance Putin. Is that a fair assessment? Why would we be shy about taking a hard line with Putin about destabilizing his regime?
I think because we think it would make Putin more threatening. The unimpeachable evidence from decades of dealing with this guy, and I don't know why people do this, because we know this, is the exact opposite is true. Putin respects and fears strength, and he sees weakness and accommodation and appeasement as a green light to just go get more. And I'll give you a perfect example of this, told to me by somebody who got it from a Russian government official, which is the Russians had some mercenaries in Syria. For whatever reason, these mercenaries decided to attack an American base. President Trump basically said, take them out. They just literally flattened the earth with these guys. Right. That message got back to Putin, and Putin was like, oh, okay, let's make sure we don't do that anymore.
Well, so then is this – so what you would argue was not the posture of the Trump administration that we don't want to destabilize him because we could get somebody worse, but it seems to be the posture of the Biden administration?
Well, I think there's two things. I don't think that the Trump administration made any effort to destabilize the Russian regime. And I don't really think that's necessary. What Trump did is he made a very serious effort to deter Putin in his foreign policy. So he was actually incredibly strong on the Ukraine, incredibly tough on sanctions, kicked out a bunch of Russian spies, tried to block Nord Stream 2, gave offensive weapons to the Ukrainians. And so he matched Putin measure for measure. If Putin did something aggressive, Trump did something three times more aggressive back to him. I think that's what's really key. What's really key for us is we don't really care about Russia. What we care is that Russia doesn't destabilize Europe. Putin doesn't, and this is another factor, Putin doesn't have a free lunch at home either. It is true that he has pretty much crushed his domestic political opposition. His economy is okay. He's tremendously benefited from Biden's energy policies. So Russian energy is bringing in good money, that enough to keep the regime going. That's not really a problem. He does have a serious COVID problem. They've massively underreported their COVID. Their vaccine is not as dependable as the Western vaccine. And shockingly, they have very, very low usage rates in Russia. People are very, very hesitant to take the vaccine in Russia, which is very ironic because the Russians have actually been bombarding Moldova and Ukraine and Georgia and Romania with fake information about, oh, the Western vaccines will you die and everything else. And actually, it's the Russians who are the most risk averse to taking vaccines. So that's a real challenge. People are dying in St. Petersburg at really unprecedented rates. So he's got and actually, if you can, from the kind of covert polling, right? I don't know how they do this, but people that get into Russia and actually, you know, manage to ask Russians what they really think, overwhelmingly Russians have no interest in invading Ukraine at all.
I wanted to talk about the border. The mayor of Yuma, Arizona, has declared a local emergency there because of his city being overrun by people coming to this country illegally. We know we're looking at 2 million migrants who have been arrested illegally attempting to cross the border this year, which is a 30-year high. But another number that's even perhaps more disquieting, deportations. We know 85% of asylum applications are going to be denied, and yet that doesn't mean people get deported. We've seen deportations, according to ICE, reduced by a factor of 5 this year as compared to 2019 under Trump. And in some offices like Atlanta, Houston, the deportations are down by a factor of 10, a factor of 13. This is a major issue that's just going to breed more lawlessness, not to mention more lawlessness at the border, not to mention what it means for people in this country illegally who shouldn't be here. And we know that some element of those people will commit crimes here, as we've seen in the past. The data, it's just the data.
So often forgotten is that enforcing immigration laws is part of border security. People are less likely to want to spend $10,000, $20,000 to get smuggled into the country if they know that they're going to be get kicked out of the country and sent right back to their home country. And Once you get inside the country, the process of going through a deportation is way more difficult, way more expensive. So not deporting people is a big problem. You know, we used to say, and I don't know because COVID's probably screwed this up, but half of the people that are illegally in the U.S. are visa overstays. So if you could imagine if we had a normal global transportation system and people were coming here in kind of the numbers in a normal year, the number of illegal immigrants in the United States would absolutely just blow up. So, and this administration is making no effort in any way, shape, or form to try to get borders and immigration enforcement under control. That's a fact. Well, it's also a fact that even though it gets blown off the front pages by other, even more egregious acts by the administration, increasingly Americans all over the country are really unhappy and upset and angry at this policy. And I think the third thing is if you are running for president in 2024 and you get elected in 2025, you will get elected with a demand from the American people that one of the first things you do is immediately secure the border and you immediately start deporting people in large numbers to get this back under control. And if you are running for president and you don't have a plan to do that, you are in big trouble when you start. And the only thing that's going to change that I worry about in the meantime is I really worry about the next 9/11 coming from border crossers. And I just look at the clock and I watch it tick down 3 years and I just worry it's going to happen.
Did you hear what Governor DeSantis proposed? I mean, he kind of said it tongue in cheek, but he's budgeting $8 million to send illegal immigrants, you know, back to where they came because they're shipping them there via planes in the middle of the night. But he said that what if he sent them to Delaware, to Martha's Vineyard, then the border would be secure the next day. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't think it would because I think the far left is so hammerlocked in the president on this that I just don't see how he voluntarily changes these policies. I will say if you look at the raft of measures that DeSantis proposed that he's going to impose in the state to make it more difficult for illegal aliens to be in the state. And then you look at the list of heritage recommendations. They look shockingly similar.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of remarkable, this snapback in the first year of Biden with control of Congress. It's basically going back to restating the rationale for Trump's candidacy in 2016, both with respect to lawlessness at the border and how that seeps into the rest of the country, combined with now something that's even exacerbated, even provides more rationale than it provided for Trump in 2016, which is the domestic crime in major cities because of the defund and decarceration Democrats.
And the other thing is when Trump ran in 2016, and what he was proposing, it was all theoretical, because nobody had ever done that. But the difference now is in 4 years under President Trump, the border was largely secured. Immigration enforcement was working in the manner in which it was supposed to. And we were even looking at kind of reforming the legal immigration system. Mm-hmm. So there is a playbook to follow. You know, it's like if you won the Super Bowl last year and you can bring the same team back, there's a good chance you can win the Super Bowl, you know, next year. So I think there, you know, again, I think the challenge for a person that would challenge Biden, and I, you know me, I do policy, not politics. So what do I know? But and if there is a different president, they should be able to walk in the front door with a team that's experienced and knows how to do this, that can do it in a way that is effective. And I will tell you two things. One is, you know, people will say that's inhumanity. We have more inhumanity, more sadness, more tragedy, more destruction on the border than we have ever had. And if you think of the 100 people who died in the horrible car crash in Mexico, all this blood is on Biden's hand. He has created all this human misery. And the most humane thing you can do at the border is stopping illegal trafficking and the cartels. So it's not inhumane. And the other thing is people say, oh, my God, it'll cost a ton of money. But when you add up the cost of opioid deaths and criminal deaths and damage to the economy and environmental damage and everything else, let me tell you, securing the border is a bargain. And then you throw something like stopping another 9/11, which, by the way, was on the order of like $500 billion. Border security is pretty dang cheap.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP at the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. His book, Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Lieutenant Colonel Jim, thanks as always.
Yeah, I hear it makes a great Christmas gift.
It does. Brutal War. Brutal War. It's
gather around the tree, little kitties.
It's right up there with a Christmas carol for the season.
If you buy it from the publisher, you get it in a significant discount. I'm just saying. I don't know.
Very good. Absolutely.
Could be a stocking stuff.
Always be closing. Very good, Jim.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. There has been a lot of ink and airtime devoted to George Soros' funding of non-prosecution prosecutors like Kim Fox in Cook County, appropriately so. But there's another billionaire that doesn't have the same profile, and maybe he deserves seeing his profile raised. His name is John Arnold. He's a former energy trader. He's a billionaire philanthropist out of Texas. His various undertakings include a bail calculation tool. This is part of his Advancing Pretrial Policy Research. It's a website. A bail calculation tool used in a lot of jurisdictions covering 75 million people in this country, including Cook County, including Milwaukee County, like Waukesha, the bail calculation tool that may have been employed to determine that the Christmas parade killer should get $1,000 bail, should be out on $1,000 bail for trying to run over his girlfriend with a car before he ran over and killed 14 people with his car. Also, the Arnolds are known to fund other leftist undertakings, including single-payer health care, pro-abortion stuff. The website states that jurisdictions must adhere to the core responsibilities and follow practices to implement the assessment with fidelity and user responsibility. He gives this bail calculation tool away for free, but then you're required to adhere to it to continue to enjoy it. And this is supposed to be algorithmic and rooted in actuarial tables, but there's real question about whether it is. And, oh, by the way, to the extent that these jurisdictions, including Milwaukee County and Cook County, are using them, what have we seen in terms of the work product? For more on this topic, one I hope is brought up during her testimony today, we're joined by Amy Swearer, who is a legal fellow at the Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. She is testifying at a Senate Judiciary Committee field hearing entitled Combating Gun Trafficking and Reducing Violence in Chicago this morning at 9 a.m. Amy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
What about this piece of it, the tools that county prosecutors are using, maybe judges as well, then, to set bail in these cases? So we talk about the lament of police and citizens alike, people being charged with crimes, including felonies, previous convicted felons, they're turned right back on the street, very low bail. We know there's these no bail reform laws, but what about the actual tools and who's funding them? That doesn't seem to me that to have been a very significant part of the conversation to date.
Well, so I think you're right. That part of it has not been too much of the conversation. And then I think part of that is at the end of the day, what we're looking at are numbers about the effect. Right. The effects of these systems, whatever they are, whoever's funding them, the effects have been pretty darn clear. I mean, especially right here in Cook County, you look at, you know, again, regardless of people's good intentions, regardless of, you know, how useful criminal justice reform can be, that the reality is that the hard numbers here are that this is bad for public safety, the way that it is being implemented, especially these new bail policies. When you look at the studies that don't fudge the numbers or sort of mischaracterize which crimes are violent and which are not, you find something to the effect of, right here in Cook County, a 33% increase in the number of defendants who are released on bail and then charged in the meantime with committing new violent crimes. That's a pretty substantial number. That's not something you want to see, especially when you have all of these other factors, frankly, across the nation that are leading to this, since we've seen since 2020 this sort of nationwide spike in gun violence. These sorts of bail policies are exacerbating the problem, as well as sort of tangential to that, right, are these very progressive prosecutorial tactics where we're seeing things like in Cook County, five gang members getting picked up on a Friday for shooting, something like 70 rounds into a residential neighborhood. And then by Monday, they're released, not just with no bail, but not facing any charges whatsoever. So I think all of these things are combining together to cause these problems. And I think that's part of the reason that has been, much more of the standard talking point. Is because at the end of the day, those are the things that are jeopardizing public safety.
Yeah, but why is Kim Fox, is it Jukes's, her way of non-charging as a way to correct past injustices? Or what exactly do you think it is why she's letting so many people go on I bonds or no bonds whatsoever?
It's a good question. I think the standard underlying premise is, this is part of general criminal justice reform. That there are times where, we are overcharging people or we shouldn't be charging people. For example, this is a state where you have people like Vivian Brown, who is an otherwise upstanding citizen who has spent 5 years fighting criminal charges for possessing a .22 caliber, bolt action single shot rifle in her home without a firearm owner's identification card. Right. So there are instances of overcharging that are very bad. Right. But the problem is, when you take this so far that you start making a mockery of true criminal justice reform, that's the problem that you run into. And it is sort of mind-boggling.
Well, right? It also seems, look, it's like rank order priority. It's a small fraction of the Chicago's population that commits a preponderance of the violent crime. And police largely know who they are. And when you have just this year some five or six dozen people charged with trying to kill or killing someone while who are convicted felons. They were, electronic monitoring and so forth. I mean, it just seems like let's focus on the habitual violent criminals. We know who they are. We know what their records are. And if you can't deal with that small cohort of the city's population, then you can't deal with anything.
Right. No, absolutely. Because that is unfortunately what we know about violence and violent crime generally is it tends to be this very small subset of very serious repeat offenders who, anytime you release them on bail, that's sort of what you see. It's this small cohort perpetuating or at least being, centrally involved in a lot of these crimes. So you're right. That is an important aspect of it. And it's also this idea of deterrence, right? The idea that swift and certain punishment is good at deterring people from committing crimes. When you have situations like I just mentioned, where you have people getting into shootouts, getting into gang shootouts in residential neighborhoods on a Friday, being released on a Monday with no charges whatsoever, even though the whole thing's caught on camera, what that says to other would-be criminals in Chicago is, yeah, it's totally fine. Go keep shooting people, go keep doing your criminal thing. And there's very good chance that even if we pick you up, we're not going to charge you. And even if we do charge you, it's a good chance we let you out on very low with no bail. That's not a deterrent effect. That doesn't deter anybody whatsoever.
What are the other policy issues you're going to raise at this hearing this morning?
So I think part of it is, using Chicago as sort of a stand-in to this reality of, 2020, something very clearly happened in 2020 that has just devastated an otherwise three-decade trend toward, lower gun violence and homicide rates. And so what I do is I look at, what essentially that question, what changed
in 2020. And what we see is that obviously, you know, we went through a global pandemic. We went through several periods of widespread unrest. All of this is very devastating to these policies that came out of that were devastating to people's social networks, these sort of vital gun violence interruption networks, many of which are very informal, that couldn't continue operating under severe shutdown and stay at home orders or with very profound social distancing aspects. You saw the way that police departments deployed their resources altered dramatically. You saw them pull back from a lot of the very proactive practices that normally are very good at interrupting measures of violence. These sorts of things, as well as this movement to defund the police, to cut police budgets, the lack of morale that caused among officers. All of these things combined with these rogue prosecutorial practices sort of created this perfect firestorm, this national environment that was ripe for violence based on everything we know about how violence works. And those are not, sort of simple talking points you can wrap up into a nice, neat little bow as a politician, right? It's a lot messier, but those are the starting points that we need to work on when we're looking at this violence fight from 2020. We need to look at our own policies that we put in place during 2020 to deal with some of this, and how it didn't, it had these very detrimental side effects, and we need to talk about that.
And in terms of, the incentives presented, the other thing with respect to the actual perpetrators of these crimes is what the law-abiding see from their justice system in terms of their willingness to get involved and to identify people and so forth. And so they see, for example, in Chicago, 10% of those who shot someone and were approaching 4,000 this year, 10% are arrested. One in five homicide cases is cleared. So they see not only so it's not just the perpetrators that see how the system works. It's also the law-abiding residents that say it's not worth my time because the chances they're not going to get caught. And if they do, they're not going to get prosecuted or they're not going to serve a significant amount of time.
Absolutely. I mean, it's detrimental to everyone's sense of well-being. When criminals feel they sort of have the reins to do whatever, because there's a very low likelihood of them being caught. And again, you look at sort of what plays into this when you have on 2 years of, again, not just in Chicago, but sort of across the nation, changes in the way that police are being deployed. Whether they're enforcing COVID-related measures, whether it's, these sorts of measures to sort of withdraw due to anti-police sentiment, and the sort of like social justice aspect of policing, where we're going to stop these minor stops for people that are actually very good in the long run at catching criminals, preventing crime, the sort of hotspot policing. When you do that, you wind up with those lower crime clearance rates. You wind up catching especially for things like homicide or shooting,
And not to interrupt, but it's not just police stops, too. It's also prosecuting lower-level offenses like these smash-and-grab robberies and, the idea that you have to steal $1,000 worth of stuff before we think that robbery is a problem. That also sends a pretty clear message.
I mean, it's across the board, this sort of message of, like who's really in charge here? Am I as a would-be criminal, am I going to face consequences, whether it's homicide, whether it's getting into a shootout in a residential neighborhood, whether it's a smashing robbery, am I really going to face consequences for that? And I think it's very clear that, again, based on a lot of these combination of factors that we just talked about, the answer in most cases is no, you're really not. And that really does, it's detrimental to the mindset of law-abiding citizens, and it bolsters sort of the confidence of criminals to keep committing crimes, even while they're out on bail. For example, just the other week, you had I think it was the 56th time in Chicago this year, you had an individual out on felony bail who was, that we know, tried to shoot or did, in fact, murder someone with a gun
right.
while out on felony yep. bail. That right. individual was already out on bail for another violent crime, out on probation on top of that. You know, it's just mind-boggling that, you know, when that happens, all these ample opportunities to lock that individual back up, nobody bothered to do so.
Well, hopefully the Democratic politicians will listen to you and do something.
You can hope. She is Amy Swearer, legal fellow, Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. She's testifying at a Senate Judiciary Committee field hearing this morning, combating gun trafficking and reducing violence in Chicago. Say hey to Sack of Durbin. It'll be interesting to see what he has to say on this topic.
We'll be watching. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
I want Christmas. Just give me plain baby Jesus lying in a manger. Christmas.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Danny Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Well, will wonders never cease? Last week, the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, which is Democrat majority, told the Democrat Socialist Governor Tom Wolf that he can't just make up the law as he goes along unilaterally, and rescinded the state's mask mandate for schools. The state Supreme Court did there.
There is a God.
But the difference, if you're thinking, oh, well, that could happen in Illinois, maybe. But the difference between Illinois and Pennsylvania is Pennsylvania has a Republican Party. That was led by Republican legislators, that action. On Friday, the teachers' unions filed a motion to intervene in a Sangamon County, that's Springfield, state capital, Sangamon County lawsuit to keep the governor's student mask mandate in place here in response to that lawsuit filed back in October we discussed by Tom DeVore, representing 145 school districts across the state that would rescind the mask mandate and make it a local decision, as it will now be in Pennsylvania. So we'll see. Where are we at? Where are we at with Omicron and everything else? Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, our friend from Stanford, was asked that question on a Ricochet podcast by hosted by Peter Robinson and Rob Long at Ricochet.com. And here's what Dr. J, our Dr. J, Dr. Stanford's Dr. J, had to say about what he would recommend the Biden administration do right now. And, of course, we know they won't.
I would say declare victory and move on. Like, this is something what they should have done in July. I mean, remember the July 4th, go have a barbecue with your friends speech? I mean, that was a golden opportunity for the Biden administration to declare victory. You know, because even by then we had vaccines, monoclonal antibodies, and rapid tests. They could have declared, and that's what they should do now. They should say, look, this is a disease that will be with us forever. If you're older and more vulnerable, you know, you still need to be careful. But here are these tools to make it so such and so bad. If you go get vaccinated if you haven't. Here are monoclonal antibody centers. Do what Governor DeSantis did. Make them widely available. Have strike force teams. You just call them up and they come to your house and infuse you. Push really hard for rapid for good trials of these relatively cheap drugs. And then just say, look, we have these tools now. Go live your life. That's it. Declare victory. I mean, it would be a bipartisan victory. They need to rein in the CDC, which has been spreading this fear. Instead, what they did is they decided that they were going to use the vaccination campaign as a tool to marginalize Republicans. The weird thing is that it's not just Republicans that started distrusting them. Large fractions of minorities in the United States aren't vaccinated. Why? Because they don't trust public health. Large fractions of younger populations are not vaccinated because, you know, the benefit is marginal, and people again don't trust public health. I think that's the problem. They need to like restore trust and declare victory.
Let's get a second opinion on that. We're pleased to be joined by Dr. Roger Klein, expert with the Regulatory Transparency Project's FDA and Health Working Group, former director of molecular oncology at the Cleveland Clinic, and former advisor to FDA, CDC, CMS, and HHS. Dr. Klein, thanks for joining us. What do you think? Should that be the priority right now, Fauci and company trying to restore trust in public health, or is that not something that will be feasible in the near term?
Yeah. Hi, Dan. Hi, Andy. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think Dr. Bhattacharya, I largely agree with what he said, and I think it's critical that individuals have confidence in public authorities, health or otherwise, and I think it's been shattered. And I, you know, victory may be a strong term, that's more of a political message, but I think he's right in that we've made enormous progress, and this is a natural disaster. It's like a hurricane; you're not going to stop it. And as little as people want to acknowledge this, we can't control it. What we can do is we can influence it, and we have through vaccines and through emerging therapeutics.
Yeah, but then you have, like, I don't know if you heard what happened in New Orleans, but Tulane University, population 13,600 students, 80 of them have COVID. They shut down the men's basketball program for a few weeks, and their school is 97% fully inoculated. So what does that say about the vaccines?
Well, it says less about vaccines than it does about the people who are making decisions. I mean, nobody's arguing that they're perfect. I think that the problem is fundamentally we have to develop immunity to this virus so that it doesn't hurt people when they get infected. The first step is vaccines. They go a long way. But, you know, if you use common sense, you might say, well, okay, people are vaccinated now, and most people aren't going to be hurt by this virus because they're vaccinated. So wouldn't it be better for them to get exposed to it when we know that there are a lot of data that suggests that what they call natural immunity or immunity based on exposure to the virus itself is durable and broader than that conferred by vaccines. And at a minimum, even if it weren't as good, and it looks as if it may be better, together the two are really going to help tame and conquer this virus so that it becomes just something we live with, like the many other respiratory pathogens with which we coexist.
I want to get your opinion on this testing controversy. The Biden administration decided to run at-home COVID-19 testing through private insurance because they concluded it would be too costly and inefficient to simply send the rapid test to all Americans for free. This is a Politico story reporting this. It's interesting, from the same people who think it's appropriate to send ballots to everyone. That's not too costly or inefficient, but rapid tests apparently is. And it's getting some real pushback from infectious disease experts. Celine Gounder, who's an infectious disease specialist who advised the Biden transition's COVID-19 response, she said it's offensive and unbecoming of someone representing the White House. It's like they want to appear like they're doing something, but aren't as concerned about actual impact because, of course, of the cumbersome nature of running this through private insurance and reimbursements and so forth. What about the testing? I mean, here we are on the cusp of 2 years since the initial testing fiasco, the great panjan drums like Fauci being unprepared for mass testing in February of 2020, and we still have this testing matter in controversy.
Yeah, sending out test kits probably does seem like a really great idea, sending them to everybody, given how well it worked with ballots. So there's a precedent for success in that area.
Or checks.
You know, in my view, people should be tested when they're sick, you know, for diseases when they're sick. And I think that they should see doctors and they should, I have a problem with people getting tested at home. Absolutely not. If somebody wants to get tested, they should be able to do what they want. But I'm skeptical of this notion that we can control through micromanagement all of these, this really contagious virus that, for which most people, especially now they're vaccinated, who are going to get exposed, don't get sick. I was at a conference last weekend, and I was tested multiple times for COVID. Everybody there was tested before going in. I know they may have had a couple of people, but I
You know, I just don't think that, I don't think it's effective. I don't think it's going to stop the spread or prevent anybody from getting sick.
But you do agree with, I mean, just to be explicit, you do agree sort of the declaration that this emergency is over. By the way, that was a declaration just made by Colorado Governor Jared Polis, who's a Democrat. This emergency is over, and we have these tools, like Dr. Bhattacharya was saying, and now go live your lives and stop being afraid.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, I've agreed with that. I actually have thought that, and I know Dr. Bhattacharya has as well, have thought that for quite some time. I don't,
right.
I think you need to medicalize it. Look, if somebody's sick, of course you want to know why they're sick and they should be tested. But this notion that I don't agree with testing people indiscriminately. If they want to get tested and they want to buy a test kit or do something, it's fine. But I don't really think that there's this this idea somehow that we're actually going to stop this virus. We have coronaviruses that circulate as colds. I mean, it's not,
right.
There are other coronaviruses, but this idea that somehow we're going to stop, we're not going to stop the flu by getting, you know, getting flu tested. I think it's a good idea to know if you have elderly relatives, particularly if they're not vaccinated, but I think we're just overdoing it.
Well, I mean, compare what the governor of Colorado said to what our governor tweeted yesterday. And granted, we had a deadly tornado, but he tweeted this. I want to remind you that in the state of Illinois, we have some of the most stringent mitigations that you can have right now. In fact, we're one of six states that has a mask mandate for indoors. If mask mandates worked, why are our numbers so high compared to our neighboring states that didn't have a mask mandate?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense. And now I've gone to two conferences in the last month, and there were mask mandates, one by the conference, one by the city, but at neither conference were people willing to do it. So I think there's some element of civil disobedience, and I saw very few people relative to the total wearing them. And they obviously aren't stopping this virus from moving. And again, our emergency, I think it's not been an emergency really since we've been able to vaccinate elderly people. It's a problem. I don't want to underestimate it. I just think that our ability to control it in fine detail is essentially non-existent. Go ahead.
That sad little man was on yesterday, talking to Clinton Foundation Donor Zero, asking about responding, I should say, to the question, boosters forever? And here's what Fauci said.
You know, George, it's tough to tell because the third shot of an mRNA could not only do what we absolutely know it does, is it dramatically increase the level of protection, but from an immunological standpoint, it could very well increase the durability of protection by things that you can't readily measure by the level of antibodies, that you might have a maturation of the immune system that would prolong the durability. You don't know that, George, until you just follow it over a period of months.
What I take away, we may not have to do boosters forever, but only if this extended durability he's hoping that he's hoping for comes to pass.
Yeah, but what about the durability that comes with getting infected? And when you're protected and you're not going to get sick, you get a flu or you get nothing. Why not talk about that and talk about the need to ultimately coexist with a pathogen that's going to continue to mutate and therefore produce additional variants, which are probably not going to cause harm? When you're exposed to multiple proteins from the virus rather than just the spike protein to which the vaccines are directed, it seems logical that you wouldn't have as deep a protection or as broad a protection when new mutations arise in the virus. So I think that Dr. Fauci is really there's a certain hubris here. I mean,
really, you don't say.
Yeah,
yeah. Let me ask you this: do you think that this purposeful treatment of the naturally immune as unvaccinated is the greatest affront to science that has occurred during this last 2 years?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of mistakes and a lot of not following science. I think it's extraordinarily strange, to be honest with you. I don't understand why we, given the data that we have and the studies that have come out and kind of logic, why we have pretended that people who have had COVID are identical to those who have not. It doesn't. There's no way to justify it, and I don't. You know, I just think this is so unrealistic, and we've drifted very far from, I think, a logical, sensible, dispassionate approach to dealing with a disease that, you know, in the end was never that serious for most people, but for some could be fatal. And we haven't been logical. And again, this hubris of this notion that we can control this in its finest detail is just not there. It's not going to happen. We evolved immune systems for this purpose. That's why we have immune systems. You know, when you look back, we developed them in order to protect us against external pathogens.
Well, Dr. Klein, do we have to go, Dan? Are we up against the
clock? Go ahead.
Well, real quick, what is it behind, and what's the science behind the fact that most people that get severely ill or die from COVID are obese? Because one local doctor said that COVID attacks the fat cells to get to your lungs, but I don't really trust that doctor. Do you know anything about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that there's an association. In fact, people who are obese do worse. Why? I mean, there's probably some immunological reasons. Having had COVID, I actually, in anticipation, because I knew it was seemed likely to get it, lost considerable weight. And I think the respiratory aspects of the disease itself are a tremendous strain. And one could see how having, when you're overweight, you have your airways, you have fat blocking the airways, you have a diminished ability to breathe, probably a diminished ability to aerate the lungs and clear the virus. And that could I would assume that could contribute to. I don't know if the pathophysiology or science behind that is exactly worked out, but it's a true relationship, and it makes a lot of sense if you've had it.
Dr. Roger Klein, expert with the Regulatory Transparency Project's FDA and Health Working Group, former director of molecular oncology at the Cleveland Clinic, and former advisor to the FDA, CDC, CMS, and HHS. Dr. Klein, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A little less than a year and a half ago, David Lampert, the CEO of Lester Lampert, jeweler, Chicago, wrote an open letter to Lori Lightfoot. 2020 was supposed to be a special year for us. We survived the pandemic, but we were immediately hit by a wave of rioting on May 30th, damaging our facade, destroying the store we share a wall with on the east side of our building. In the latest rounds of rioting on August 10th, our store was actually broken into, and we sustained severe damage and loss. This is not how we were hoping our 100th year would have been. His grandfather started Lester Lampert Jewelers in 1920. He said at the time, August of 2020, "It is disheartening to see what our city has become." We talked to David Lampert. He came on the show to discuss his open letter and what he and his colleagues in the business community in River North and the Gold Coast were thinking at the time. That's almost a year and a half ago.
And what's changed?
And last week, after another spat of smash and grabs at Louis Vuitton and elsewhere,
Neiman Marcus, North Face, Canadian Goose, the list goes on and on.
This is what you got from Lightfoot.
"I'm disappointed that they're not doing more to take safety and make it a priority. We still have retailers that won't institute plans like having security officers in their stores, making sure that they've got cameras that are actually operational."
Mm-hmm. blaming the victim. The retailers aren't doing enough.
It's their fault.
No comment on the city that has the primary responsibility of providing for public safety, along with the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, along with the Cook County criminal justice system writ large. So that would include those Cook County Circuit Court judges, too. And then over the weekend, on Saturday, in broad daylight, at noon, you had two criminals come in and rob Gold Coast Exotic Motors on Rush Street. Thankfully, no one was hurt. But obviously, that sort of continued violence and looting and the rationalization of it and the dismissal of the concerns of the business community and residents alike is getting some people to speak out who maybe don't want to wade into this business of politics, just want to run their business. One of them is Joe Perillo, who owns Gold Coast Exotic Motors, and he joins us now. Joe Perillo, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So over the weekend, first of all, there's pretty quick thinking from your sales associates who have concealed carry licenses to defend your business and defend the people that were in your business and get those burglars to scatter, although they made off with seven figures worth of jewelry. But you got to be pretty proud of how your staff reacted.
Yeah, no, they're there to protect their lives and our customers' lives. They're not there to create a problem. They're here to stop a problem. But first of all, I'd like to start out for thanking the Chicago Police Department. We have the greatest police department. I want them to get that message. We got the greatest police department in the nation, and they're wonderful, wonderful police. But they've been apparently told to stand down or they're helpless. If I were a Chicago policeman and I heard there was a problem, I'd probably go the other way. And I'm not a coward. But if you become the victim, you become the person that you're trying to solve the problem, and you become the problem. So let me just. I can't say enough about the Chicago Police Department and how I feel about them and that they're told to stand down. But what happened with me, if you want me to, you want me to talk right now?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Please.
Tell us what
please.
Happened. Yeah.
Okay, so I was Saturday I started out at BMW and I had a pep talk at BMW. And then I went out to Downers Grove and I had a pep talk with them and wished them well for Christmas. And then I came back to Gold Coast and I was not aware that within an hour of me coming to Gold Coast, that there was this smash and grab. Now, they came in, and when I saw this, I was just fed up. I was just fed up, and I came around the time when the news media came. There were three. It was Channel 2, Channel 7, and Fox News, and I was just all amped up, and I was angry. I was angry and disgusted. Enough is enough. I was broken into twice last year. Broke my windows, broke my showcases, broke everything. And we didn't do anything wrong. We haven't done anything wrong. And so if people are calling me. There's an outcry from calling me and feeling sorry for me. This is not about me. I'm not talking about this for me. I love this city, Chicago. I was born and raised here. I love this city, and it's about – I'm watching the city get the Lori Lightfoot and Fox. They inherited a wonderful city. They're ruining a wonderful city. Their legacy is going to be they ruined a great city if we don't turn this around. And I was not aware that everyone felt as passionate as I did. No one has come forward and said this, and I said two words. Enough is enough is how I started the interview. I've been bombarded by people all over the country. My emails are blowing up, my text messages, people that I know are getting out, they feel sorry for me. I feel sorry for all the neighbors. They don't buy cars for me. They want to take their kids out for a walk, are afraid that people want to go to dinner. They don't know if they're going to get stuck up. This is the city of Chicago, a city that works. Okay, and I'm just fed up with it. And everyone is texting me and they're saying enough is enough. So I'd like to start a movement, enough, enough movement.
Well, what do you want to say to Mayor Lightfoot, who says that it's your fault because you didn't have enough security guards there or outside the store checking people going in?
What would my security guards have done? My people could have protected themselves. We stand down. What are we going to do? If a security guard shot one of these people, I'd probably lose my license. I'd probably be on court. I'd get sued. So you stand down and you watch them rob you.
Right.
I mean, this is disgusting. Okay? I didn't realize I've been bombarded by people telling me all the crime that's been happening, okay, around that I didn't know. But I was wondering, how could people just stand by and not say anything? Well, I was about one of those people that wasn't going to say anything because I have a lot of customers. 50% of the people, or I'd say more now, are for this. I would think it's split 50-50. If you rate 50 in anything, you're a loser. Mm-hmm. So by not saying you're not a loser, well, someone's got to stand up say something. Enough is enough.
We've been hoping for a Howard Beale, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take in any more moment in this city for a long time. I mean, I just referenced the Lampert Jewelers guy, Dave Lampert. That's a year and a half old now, and maybe this will be it. I hope this will be it, but I don't know. What is the reaction you're getting from business owners that you know in and around the city?
I mean, business owners are calling me and they're thanking me for going forward. But here's what I was going to say.
Okay.
I just have to say this. Yesterday, when I did that interview, I had a lot of hate in my heart. I hated Lori Lightfoot. I hated Tim Fox. I hated the thieves that came in. And more as the day came by, I started to reflect on it. I reflected on my childhood. I came from my dad died when I was 13 years old. My mother's an immigrant. Okay, my mother was 37. We had no money. If the laws were what they are now, and I came from, there were plenty of thieves in my neighborhood and thugs. And my idols at the time were the thieves and the thugs. So I could relate to these kids. I lived it. I saw it. I would have been a thug.
Yep.
I went to the Army when I was 17, and it changed my life. Okay? If the laws were what they were there, I would have been a thief instead of a car dealer. But I went to the Army, and I came back from the Army, and I went to, after my basic training, I went to Asia, and I was there for a year. I came back and I went to my old neighborhood. I went to the street corner. The same thugs were staying there planning on stealing. Okay? I saw what a difference it was. I feel sorry. I really feel sorry. I think that Lori Lightfoot and Kim Fox are probably good people. It's hard to believe, but I think I don't know them. But I hated them yesterday. Now I feel sorry for them because I think they're trying to do right for their constituents, but they're doing wrong. Instead of creating business people, they're creating thieves. And these kids go back to their neighborhoods and they become role models. And they're probably 17 or 18 years old. Instead of going out and getting a job to get a car, they get a gun and go out and steal a car. They go back with that car to their neighbor and all their friends look up to them. So we're building a network of thieves.
Well, when's enough is enough for you? Are you going to plan on staying in Chicago or moving, your business elsewhere?
I'm an optimistic person. I like to work on win-win situations. I like to take losing situations and make winning. I've done it my whole life. I started out a loser. I had nothing to lose. I had to work hard. People look at me and think I just was born with a silver spoon. We were broke. Okay? Mm-hmm. I feel sorry for these kids because by letting them go, by stealing $950 worth of merchandise and letting them go, by walking into a restaurant and then not paying a bill, they go back to their neighborhood and they become role models. So by taking them and what they really should be doing, the judge should take these 17 and 18-year-old kids and say, when he finds them guilty, say, you got a choice, 2 years in jail or 2 years in the Army. The Army will straighten them out, and they'll come back and be better people and love the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's I'm sorry, I'm not yelling. I'm just so passionate about this.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I mean, I agree. I mean, that there is the disintegration of all of these institutions, including those charged with enforcing the law. But there also has to be accountability. These kids who maybe get in with the wrong crowd and do something bad, they got to pay the price for it. And also, the politicians have to pay the price for what happens on their watch. And that just doesn't happen in Chicago. And to me, you know, you're seeing a manifestation of a long duration of politicians not being held to account by the polity in Chicago and in Illinois generally. And so you see people fleeing Chicago and Illinois like it's on fire. I mean, this isn't that complicated, but I mean, more people need to sort of take the position you're taking now in the last 24 hours of speaking out, because this thing is trending away from civilization quickly.
Well, here's the whole thing. By trying to be nice to these thieves, by letting them go, for not having any consequence, what they're doing is the only way they're going to make another living is to go steal from someone else. Okay? And right. So they're going to have either a life of crime, or they're going to be in jail, or they're going to get killed. Because someone else is going to wind up, they're going to pull a gun on the wrong guy, and the other guy's going to shoot them. They're on a dead-end street. They yep. can't win. They're not going to go from stealing. The next way, when they get rid of that merchandise they stole, they're going to have to go out and steal more merchandise. And they're going to bring a couple of friends with them, and they're going to steal. They're already closing Macy's and Neiman Marcus.
Right.
And how many other stores are going to get closed?
There's no question about it. There's no, but I mean, I think we're basically saying the same thing. But you still have, relatively speaking, a small percentage of these habitual criminals that are committing a preponderance of the crime. And if you don't hold those individuals to account under the law, then you will lose the city, as the city is being lost with each passing day. I mean, there's 1,000 murders in Cook County this year, highest in 30 years. You know what's going on. And I just don't see.
I travel a lot.
Yeah, but
I travel a lot.
Go ahead.
I travel a real lot in business.
Mm-hmm.
I've been into this last the last 45 days. I've been to Europe twice. I've been to 2 different parts of California, and I've been to 2 different cities in Texas and in Florida. And each state, when I say Chicago, even in Europe,
of course,
they say, "Do you have to walk out of your house with a gun?" Our image of Chicago has gone down the drain, and the mayor could take responsibility. Now, I will tell you, I voted for Mayor Lightfoot. I will not vote for her again. I know what politicians do. They have 2 goals. Politicians have 2 goals. One is to get elected, and the second goal is to get reelected.
Right.
Yep.
And I'll tell you, anyone who votes for them, unless they change their tune, Kim Fox, And I'll probably get every agency in the world is going to come and cause me some kind of damage right now because of me being vocal, okay? You know, I don't know what Mayor Lightfoot has in mind for me after she hears this. Mayor, I think you're a good person. I think you're trying to do the right thing. I really do. I didn't think so 2 days ago, and I'm not trying to be complimentary to you. I think in your heart of hearts, you're doing the right thing. You're doing the wrong thing. You're harvesting thugs. You're taking young kids that could become productive. Everyone is looking for help. There's not a waiter. There's not a busboy. There's not a person to get a job right now. You're not encouraging jobs. You're encouraging theft. You're encouraging these criminals. And Kim Fox, you're responsible for that too.
Well,
you know, I'm just going to be—I'm just the voice of the people in Chicago. I cannot believe the outrage. I can't believe how many people are texting me, emailing my business, calling all my friends, and complimenting me. for saying enough is enough, and we have to start a movement. Enough of a, enough is enough movement. This is it. We're frustrated. Let's take our city back.
Well, do you want to meet with Mayor Lightfoot and Kim Fox?
I'll be happy to meet with her. I have a solution. You know, everything, I struggled through high school. I'm not a rocket scientist. You can tell by talking to me. I didn't have a great education. Okay? Everything I had was based on common sense. And this is an easy, I'm about win-win situations. Let's take a negative situation and let's make a positive situation. Let's reward people for working, not people reward people for stealing, for harming people. I'm talking about, I didn't realize, Amy, how frustrated people out around the country. I thought I was just talking about Chicago. But this has gotten out around the country, and people are texting me, enough is enough.
Well, I hope that your words will start to see some scales fall from some eyes, including in the business community, because in my view, it hasn't been vocal enough. There hasn't been the leadership from the business community. In addition to other communities, there haven't been enough people to express their Howard Beale moment like you have. And, we got to change this mindset in the city.
What I'm doing is risky. What I'm doing right now is risky.
But you're you know, Ken Griffin, when he speaks out, even at his position, everybody thinks it's risky. But you got to have people. You got to have people willing to take risks. You got
to
have people willing to take risks.
I would love to talk to Ken Griffin. I would love to talk to Ken Griffin.
Absolutely,
he's an idol of mine. He's a role model of mine. This man has done more for the city of Chicago, and he's frustrated as I am. I would love to talk to Ken Griffin.
Well, it's you guy. It's you know, Joe Perillo. It's Ken Griffin. But it's David Lampert at the jewelers. It's every storefront, every business owner, every resident needs to rethink what they're going to tolerate in Chicago. And so hopefully this spurs that movement you're talking about. I really hope it does. And I certainly appreciate you coming on our show to discuss this and share your passion. Definitely comes through. We appreciate that. Joe Perillo, the owner of Gold Coast Exotic Motors. Joe, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Mr. Pearl, I'll ask Mayor Lightfoot today if she'll be willing to meet with you.
I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, I said I'll ask the mayor because she has a press conference today. I'll ask her if she's willing to meet with you.
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Pearl. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line. Whew, Dan, that was pretty impressive interview.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful story, and I'm glad he told the backstory of how he found success in this country and his family found success. I mean, tremendous respect for the businesses that he's built in Chicagoland and all that he's contributed to Chicago, talking about Ken Griffin and others. And that's fine, and I understand it's a risk for everybody, but, I mean, how many times do we have to go through this? How many times do we have to hear, the next victim in line years apart? I just don't know what it takes, but maybe Joe Perillo, maybe what he had to say over the last 24 hours, maybe it starts something. I sure hope so.
Maybe it's this. Enough is enough.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.